You can help us at History Hack by joining us via Patreon. It takes quite a lot of effort and a lot of work of quite a big team now to keep us going. And so if you could donate as little as £3 a month, it would be massively appreciated by all of us. There's different levels because Princess Marcus has set it all up with varying rewards and things. So do have a look, do join us. There's an exclusive Facebook group as well, and you can be part of all of it.
Hello and welcome to History Hack. It's Merin here and I have the delectable, the delightful Charlie with me. Charlie, hi, how are we?
I'm very good. It's nice to be with you. Walters and White taking over History Hack hosting duties.
Taking over the world, setting up new brands of ice cream and legal teams. Walters and White, it's a force to be reckoned with.
Oh my goodness, the listeners aren't going to know what's hit them. You and I and our love of all things Hollywood and theatre and musicals, we are taking over in style today.
So basically what you're saying is we're a couple of drama queens.
Oh no, no, never. Yes, I think that's fair. I think anyone who has listened for a while will know that from you and I, Merin.
Charlie, tell us who's joining us today.
Well, I'm really excited. Today we've got Tarbo with us, the creator and writer, and Ayaz, the director of 50 Days. It's a brand new musical which is bringing to life the days leading up to, drumroll please, the English Civil War. Huzzah! It's doing this. You know I'm a Civil War war guy. Sorry. You know, it's my area.
I know.
What's really exciting about 50 Days is it's doing this through the very British sound of grime. Now, if you're down with the kids like me, you know about grime. If you're not, you're going to learn a lot today. With music by Dark Star and Duramani Kamara, I may have pronounced that terribly. You have to kick me if I got it wrong. It's already been mentioned in the same breath as Hamilton. And we here at History Hack are very excited to be getting in early to tell you guys all about it before the whole world starts singing about John Pym in their cars. So hello, Tarbo and Ayaz.
Hello. Hi, guys. Hi, everyone.
Hello. Oh, lovely to be here. Thank you for the invite.
We're really, really excited, like I say, to be getting in on the ground floor. This is a new musical, and I love that new musicals are happening even in this crazy world. We're going to talk a lot about it, but just for our listeners right now, we're going to drop in a little taste of what they can expect from 50 Days.
It is I, John Pym. Now I begin. Parliament. Jump. Look, as I walk down this alley, there's a shadow of death. I fear no evil, but see there's no one left. We know not how this mortal beast manifests. Is it popish sin, or maybe the rats, maybe the cats? Either way, check out the stats, they don't look good. The king needs to face facts. I'm an MP with a seat, as a nation meets at Coleman Street to hear John Lilburn speak. I see.
Okay, so that was quite an introduction. But although I'm getting a sense of what grime is, Jazz, do you want to just give us, is there a definition of grime? How do we know we're listening to grime?
Tommy, you're probably better to describe this.
Well, but by definition and technically grime, yeah, it's probably got more in common with dance music like garage, things like that, and even dancehall. It's normally set to a 140 BPM beat, if you're going to get really technical, but that's kind of changed a little bit over time too. But yeah, it's kind of the kind of voice of the young people who kind of refuse to no longer be heard. It originated in East London. I think really the kind of gritty texture, the urgency of grime, I think that really mirrors the situation and the feeling of 1641 perfectly. There really isn't a better music choice. And it's, you know, kind of quintessentially British. I mean, Traditionally, it would have been called underground, but now you have artists like Stormzy headlining at Glastonbury, so it's no longer something that's only for the youth. It's kind of 20 years in the making, and what a 20 years it's been really for grime.
It's fantastic. I think if anyone needs a parallel, I often think of grime as being very like punk music. So if you've not heard of it, it's because you're not there. It's very, very British. And, you know, for people who perhaps have found hip hop and that kind of rap music hard to relate to, because it's very Americanized, this is talking about places that you know in an English accent, and it's so immediate and deals with such a wide range of really important issues. So you touched on that a little bit, Tarbo, but what do you think it is about that time, you know, over the winter 1641, 1642, that lends itself so perfectly to grime?
Well, I think that winter in particular, that there's a kind of radical fervor in the air. And I think those that are responsible for it are really the grime artists of their era. And, you know, like grime, they're no longer waiting for their turn to be heard. They're taking the microphone, if you will, and they're making people pay attention. And, you know, if we're going to talk a little bit about grime, well, the artists and those involved in, I think they're the kind of early pirate radio stations in the early noughties, they took huge risks for their music to be heard, but both their freedom if they're caught for piracy and equally actually risking their lives trying to make it happen, erecting aerials on tower blocks and things like that. So it was dangerous. And I think, you know, the winter of 1641, it's all cooking up in the East End, not far from where grime originated from. And there are people at street level who aren't happy with their lot, and they're becoming vocal about it, and have been for a little while. And we've got the plague looming over London, economic hardship, a huge clash over politics, religion, and this kind of new idea that, you know, everyone might be born equal, being put forward by people like John Lilburn.
What?
Yeah, and I just feel that grime represents an anti-establishment feeling of our generation, and we've got a lot in common with the radicals of the 17th century, more than you might think.
Wow.
So I'm in the sense that there's certainly a layer of urgency here, and that seems to be reflecting. I mean, Tommy, you mentioned right at the outset this idea of 140 beats per minute, and for people who don't know, I guess about 120 is about the pop rock standard. It's just slightly slower. But if you've got a sense of urgency in a time frame, then clearly grime as a framework against which to set a narrative of some kind, it lends itself perfectly. So Tom, where did you first get the idea that the two things might complement each other? Where were you? What happened?
I think it's kind of complicated. As a history teacher, but in a performing arts setting, I've always identified the value of theatre as an educational tool. And for a time, I tried to kind of make inroads into that world, but didn't really have much success, education packs and that kind of thing. So I turned around and just went, well, okay, if I'm not getting these opportunities, maybe the best thing for me to do is to write my own show. But in terms of 50 days, it was, I think, December 2018, and I'm having a drink with a friend just before Christmas. And like most people, we're talking about Brexit like we have been for about 5 years, right? and we kind of get onto the idea of the country divided, and we begin to compare it a little bit to the Civil War period. I can remember walking home, kind of heading towards Lambeth Bridge. I've walked past Parliament, I've got my headphones in, and Shut Down by Skepta comes on. And I'm looking at the statue of Cromwell, and I'm just thinking about, you know, the prorogation of Parliament, the personal rule of Charles. And I just had, you know, the kind of vision of an MC dressed as a Puritan. it kind of just grew from there, really. I think the idea of urban music on stage, it's not a new phenomenon. I mean, I remember in 2004 living in Germany. I lived in a town called Stuttgart for a short period of time with my family there, and I had the opportunity to go and watch a show called Slam Dunk, which is written by Felix Krosh MPE, And it's a hip hop, UK hip hop show about basketball, but actually loosely based on a Shakespeare play. And that's in 2004. So it's not, people have been doing it for a while. It just maybe didn't have the attention then that it does now. So I think that's quite interesting. And I remember that show so vividly, and it's really stuck with me.
It's wonderful. And you are so right. I mean, those of us who are interested in the 17th century, Civil War, and all of that time have just been banging our heads against brick walls for the last few years going, this is Brexit. We are living through everything we read in those history books, everything we learned at school. We're living through it. And we even had Pride's Purge, I believe, when Boris kicked out a load of his MPs who didn't agree with him. It really is so relevant at the moment. So, Jazz, tell us a little bit about 50 Days, because it's currently a musical in development. What does that mean? And how on earth have you guys been able to create new theatre over the last 18 months with everything going on?
Okay, cool. So to start with the development kind of stages, it's in development because we haven't had the kind of first opening night. And I would say that any new writing piece is completely in development up until you have the first show, not even the previews. I would say even the previews, sometimes you get rewrites and you get kind of little changes and things. So I think, yeah, because it's a new show, we're constantly trying to make it better, constantly trying to make it the best piece that we can. And so it will be in development right up until the last moment. It also means that we are looking to do R&Ds, which is a research and development kind of stages where we practice bits of the script, we see which works, we see how the actors respond to it, and yeah, just allow Tarbo to see what he likes and what he doesn't like about his work, and then rework it, and yeah, and hopefully at some stage we'll have a complete show that we can put on the West End, which would be, yeah, great.
And you've been doing all of this in a pandemic.
Yeah, in a pandemic. it's kind of two edges of the coin, really, because it has been difficult in terms of we haven't been able to meet loads in person and get actors in a room because of all the COVID restrictions and stuff. But it does mean that Tarbo's had a lot of time in his bedroom to write, which is great for a writer. And we've got Zoom and technologies and stuff these days, so we can communicate, and that's been a real advantage. I think it, in terms of having the distraction of other jobs, it means that you can focus more on your passion projects. Yeah. Rather than just, oh, I'm at work at the moment, so I can't work on that and everything. So, yeah, it's been good for it, and it's also been challenging for it. So I think, yeah, and it's been fun as well.
That's incredible.
We were really fortunate that Paul Taylor Mills and Turbine Theatre, they have an annual MT Fest where they try and showcase new work, new in development writing, and a lot of them are at different stages of that process. And you know, even with all of the delays with everything, they were determined to put on the festival this year, and we were, I think, really, really fortunate to have that opportunity. The cast were incredible. We had 12 hours of rehearsal for our piece, which
an hour show as well. Yeah,
yeah, which was mad. But I think Jazz and everyone just did a phenomenal job of really running with the ideas, putting their own spins on little things, and actually just creating something new and fresh, I hope. And yeah, hopefully people enjoyed it.
So I'm going to run with two threads there, because one is determination. And the other is isolation, something about which we know quite a bit. Charlie and I have had a little bit of an insight as to how this piece of musical theatre opens. When an audience first sees you and starts hearing the narrative development, what they're seeing is your characters melting into their 17th century counterparts, but it's set in a school classroom. So we've got this backdrop of understanding that we're in a civil war, in English Civil War, and you've got this very visual idea of structure. So, question for you. Do you think Charles I could have nipped all his problems in the bud, determined as he was, if he'd put John Pym in detention?
yeah, to be honest, I feel like if he had kind of put him in detention or
you know, chopped off his head is the kind of detention that he would have done at that time. I think he probably would have done that. But I feel like the nature of Charles's character and the flaw of his character means that he would never have done that, because he always underestimates his opponent, because he so fundamentally believes in the blue blood, in the divine right, that I just don't think he could have ever foreseen it. With that in mind, if he had had the kind of insight to be wary of John Pym, I think John Pym would have played a different tact. I don't think he would have come in so strong. I think he knows his opponent so much better because he hasn't had the opportunities that Charles has had, so he has to graft. I feel like he just would have navigated it and would have got out of detention. You've done it somehow.
I mean, it's kind of a Chamberlain coulda, shoulda, woulda alternative truth effects, really.
It's going to be a song of ours now.
I think the damage had been done, and it was bigger than Pym. And actually, Pym, if he'd been executed, he would have become a bit of a martyr, and someone else would have taken his place. And there was really too much at stake for a lot of the parliamentarian faction, I think, anyway. So I think that Charles tried to appease Pym, which, you know, he tries to offer him quite a meaty role in January to try and bring him over, if you will. But I kind of feel that the long-term damage had already been done.
Yeah. Okay. But I do feel that he was between a rock and a hard place, wasn't he? Because even when he did try and arrest the sort of five most prominent members of parliament who were speaking against him, they'd already gone by the time he goes marching into parliament. And you know, he was always a couple of days too late on everything.
You couldn't even get that right.
I know. It is so sad. Look, it's a rebellious subject and a rebellious sound that you've got going in 50 days. But I don't know, guys. I think there's a lot of sympathy in your production for both Charles I and his wife, Queen Henrietta Maria. Is 50 Days a secret royalist musical?
I think that what we've tried to do is to mirror our current media obsessions, and I think The Crown has reignited our fascination with the monarchy and brought in a newer audience, I think, too. And I think the Harry and Meghan debate, you know, everyone's got an opinion about it, and I think for this particular showcase and the material that we selected, we tried to mirror that. It was never really intended to be a play from the perspective of the monarchy. But with so many things, you kind of go down a rabbit hole with the research. I think equally there's a lot more written about them, so they're more easily accessible. So, it's taking a little bit longer to develop that material for the more ambiguous characters, like your Catherine Chidleys or people of that nature, who I'm just taking a bit more care with. I'm sure the perspectives will develop and change over time. But I do think that their relationship is very interesting, and I think the kind of more I read, so a lot of my initial research was, you know, your John Adamson, your Rees, people like that, and then I read The White King. Which just gave me a bit of a different perspective on their relationship, and kind of just ran with that a little bit too.
I think that's lovely. We love Leander Delisle here. She's been on and talked to us about The White King before. There's this, it's not too much of a spoiler to say, there's a really lovely song, and it could have gone on for four times the length and I would have sat there and listened to it because I loved it, where King Charles is writing almost a letter to his older brother who died, who was supposed to be the heir, not Charles. And he says that he's trapped in a cage of gold. And it's really beautiful. You've got a lot of sympathy for him there.
I feel like, if I can jump in, I feel like for us not to show that side of the royal family, I think it would do a disservice to the whole story, because I don't think we can pretend now that royal people, whatever you think about the monarchy, that they're not real people and they don't have issues or they don't suffer. I think people maybe would have expected us to kind of just have the royal family as a bit of a caricature because that's how it's portrayed in Hamilton. But I think because this is set in England, and I think King Charles is so much more involved in this revolution, that we have to have him as a three-dimensional character and not as a caricature. But yeah, and I think people can make their own decision. We don't want to tell them how to feel about it. And yeah, whatever people feel, if they're a roundhead or a royalist, they can make their mind.
That sense of perspective is really important. And I know that by using Grime, choosing Grime, you're appealing instantly to an audience that will be familiar with this genre. But then by looking at the English Civil War, you are looking at a completely different audience potentially. And it's not a case of never the twain shall meet, but oh my goodness, when they do, they're going to learn a lot about each other.
Yeah.
So with the idea of new perspectives and being open, which I think is what art and culture is all about. Art and culture is always about be open-minded. This is not me telling you what you should think or hear or see or feel. It's about you interpreting and finding your own perspective about the medium. The context and the content of what you've created says a lot about perspectives on reality. It says a lot about perspectives on fake news, about monarchy, on politics. Do you think that even if they're not aware of the Civil War, the English Civil War, do you think that there are elements of what they're seeing that will be familiar to the audience, for perhaps whom history isn't necessarily, inverted quotes, their thing? Do you think they'll recognise some of what they're seeing?
I think unquestionably, that people talk about history repeating itself, and I don't necessarily think history is repeating itself. I don't think it's ever ended. You know, you don't just shut one book and open another one. And a lot of the ideas that we're talking about in the show are the ideas that we're talking about today. And I think, you know, you talk about perspectives. It's really important to understand that the levellers or the parliamentarians, they're arguing for very different things, actually, even though they have a common enemy. And the monarchy are, they have their own agenda as well. So I think that idea of perspective is really important. And we equally try to get away from the idea of the English Civil War and make it the British Civil War to an extent, because Scotland is such an important part of the narrative, and Ireland too. So we're really trying, I think, to embed that idea of regional difference as well. Manchester is very carefully placed in the narrative too. I think hopefully there'll be something in there for everyone, and maybe being a teacher helps a little bit. I'm not sure.
Yeah, no, I feel like people are endlessly the same, and we like to think that we're progressive and that we change and that we've learned more and we understand things now. But I feel like, like our parents, we just repeat the same mistakes over and over again. And I mean, even in the word like revolution means to revolve, right? So we're just going around in circles doing the same stuff. I think it will definitely interest people who maybe feel like particularly the monarchy is not interesting to them because they feel like it doesn't relate to them. But I feel like it will draw them in a way that they haven't expected, but also it will tell the story in a way that is designed to interest and entertain. I think part of the issue is that we associate a lot of history with someone standing there going in 1485 blah blah blah, like at the beginning of our show, and it's actually the tone that is boring. It's not the content. Yeah.
Yeah, I think that anybody who, because the Civil War is something that's been taught as a part of the curriculum for years and years, and the number of people I talk to who have thought that it was very boring, and how I feel that there are some sort of flaws in the way that it's been taught, not the actual subject, because it is in fact really interesting. But if you're not interested in it, how can you inspire passion in somebody else?
Definitely. Me and Tabo went to the same school, when we both had the same history teacher. And before I went to that school, I definitely had a lot of teachers that were very, you know, in this period, kings, and it was very much like that. And as soon as we went to the Brit school and had Mr. Moy, you know, he's like a very vivacious Scottish guy. He'd be like, we're going to go to the cemetery. We're going to see this. We're gonna do that. And I was like, oh my God, this is like exciting. And yeah, he made, I knew I already loved history from visiting castles and things, but he made me love it again after having had it, you know, kind of the joy battered out at school in certain points. So yeah.
That's so wonderful. Hang on. Is your teacher / Charles the First character in 50 Days, is he in fact your history teacher from the Brit school? Because he has got a Scottish accent.
To be fair, we really liked Reuben for that, Reuben Joseph for that role, because of the fact that Charles, you know, his father's Scottish, and again, actually that regional kind of influence and representation. I think initially we had him down to actually try it in an English accent, but it just wasn't really working. And we kind of just played around with that a little bit. But as the whole classroom thing unfolded, I remember me and Ajaz looking at each other and just being like, that reminds us of someone a bit. But I think, yeah, kind of shout out to Mr. Moyer. When I kind of told him that I was writing about this, he straight away gave me a book by Christopher Hill, you know. Again, talking about different perspectives on history, you know, really important. So I've, yeah, just the amount of just doors that's opened from a history perspective for me has just been phenomenal. And actually, the development politically of Britain, you know, the prorogation of Parliament didn't happen until 2019. I'd already been writing it for, you know, a length of time, and then 2020, the pandemic, and it was just time and again, more and more things were happening that related to the period of time that we're looking at.
So you're not worried you've got a magic pen that you're sort of you're making things happen. Stop it.
So I've got a question for both of you, because having seen and heard the way that you're using grime as a genre with this fast pace, this overlay of like street lyric on a fast paced background. Is it harder to learn a syncopated lyric about history, or is it easier to learn the history and then attach that to a syncopated lyric?
Ooh. So if I'm talking about from a performance perspective as an actor, yeah. There is a rule in theatre that you never learn your script before you go into the rehearsal room, because you learn it in a certain way and then you have to unlearn it, because then the director goes, no, not like that, like this. Fine, do it. And then you go and end up doing it the same way that you've practiced it. So I would say it's easier to learn it as you're doing it rather than learning too much beforehand. I think it's always good to do your research, but if you're absorbing information whilst being with other people and playing out kind of scenarios and stuff, it's always going to stick in more. Like in school, if you learn something with a bit more kind of like a dance or a song or something, it's going to make it absorbing to you a lot quicker. So yeah, I would say do it in the room, not before.
I think everyone's different too, right? Like there were people in the cast who were very meticulous beforehand, really wanted to know about their character in a lot of depth and detail. Other people do kind of feed off the interaction in the room, and I think it's just, you know, whatever you're more comfortable with. You probably can be too over prepared, but you know, yeah, I think everyone's going to have their own preference on what they want to bring to the role. And I think for me as a debutant writer, creator, whatever you want to call it, I've definitely learned that and picked that up about different people, that they all work differently, and it's really important to respect that and let people do what works for them.
Cool. Definitely. Also, if we had, because our rehearsal period at this point was so short, there was kind of no way that there couldn't have been research done beforehand. But hopefully one day we'll get an 8-week rehearsal period and we'll have the first 2 weeks just going to Whitehall, going around all the kind of the places that are relevant to the story and doing the research.
Can I come? Do you need anyone to sort of carry bottles of water and fan the director with the big
come as Lucy Hay and do a little
excellent. Yeah, no, I will definitely come along. I'm particularly interested in the point at which historical fact meets artistic license. How have you decided which figures need to be a part of the show from history? And how do you decide what they'll sound like in a in sort of a modern musical setting?
So that's a tricky one. I think as a historian and probably as a teacher, I've got good at sifting through information and trying to decide what to include and what to omit, because you've got a limited time in a lesson, right? But mm-hmm. I think the provided you've got the big ideas, then the characters just kind of follow on after that. So in that initial scene where you've got Pym, Lilburn, Manchester all meeting, it was really difficult to decide who the characters were going to be. But that's kind of why I decided to have them as representations, one of the chamber, one of the upper house and one of the street. And they're kind of representing that entire faction in a way where, you know, if you try to include all of them, the audience is just going to get really confused with all of the Edwards, all of the, all of the Williams. That, yeah, it can be a bit overwhelming. It would just be carnage.
I feel like... the kind of initial thing that we decided for this stage of the project was who can't we tell the story without? Who do we definitely need in the story for all those points? We had a bit of a discussion about Lucy Hay because we both really love her as a character, but we at that time we didn't have really enough time to bring her in and do her justice, but she's definitely coming in a bit more later.
Tell our listeners who Lucy Hay is. Where would she fit?
So, Tabo, do you want to go with this? Do you want to know a lot?
So, Lucy Hay, Countess of Carlisle, is lady in waiting for the Queen and her best friend. I think she's 10 years her senior. She's really, really politically influential at court. Actually, she's got a lot of favour and she's able to kind of manoeuvre politically through that scene. Quite an independent woman, independent thinker for that time period, and someone that we felt we really wanted to kind of include in the narrative. But you know, I kind of mentioned earlier that there are people where there is more information and they're easier to write. And we're really taking our time with Lucy, and she plays a massive role in the political shift and change and the game of the 50-day period in question. We'll hopefully have more to write about and tell you all about in regard to Lucy fairly soon.
Very exciting.
It's fascinating to hear how it's evolving as a production, and clearly it's not as I would put it naively, as simple as I'll write some music, I'll put a few lyrics down, we'll choose a period of history, I know, we'll put some costumes on and we've got a production.
It's not as easy as Gene Kelly made it look in Singing in the Rain. Just making a musical.
I mean, to be fair, that doesn't look that easy to me. I was...
Yeah, ditto.
So tell me, which stage are you at and what's next in production? What's the next stage of development?
I think back to the drawing boards, writing more material, developing the concept, and hopefully, we'll be able to do what we did at MT Fest on a larger scale. And I love the idea that it's kind of in development, and we're showing people that development because you can bring people along for the journey, and kind of show people the vulnerability of making a production too. So hopefully people can feel like they're actually part of the 50 Days family.
I think also because we've decided to kind of do two stories in our show, we've got the modern day setting and we've got the time period that we're doing, 1640s. You can't just kind of start one kind of storyline and not finish it. So we have to work out how dramaturgically they fit together and how they work alongside each other, which is a lot more kind of pattern shifting and structural work that we need to work on. But it makes it more fun. And
it really is. It does feel like it's alive. It's like a living organism, and it's going to change and evolve and with feedback that you get, it's really wonderful. Feedback from me, please put Lucy Hay in, because she totally sells the Queen out. I mean, we don't know for sure that she was the one who tipped off Parliament that the King was coming to arrest the five members, but it's a brilliant, it's just such a great story.
Yeah, and actually her relationship with John Pym, you know, what is that relationship? Is it romantic? Is it actually just political? Really yeah. hard to tell. And, you know, again, it's just that idea of really taking care with her storyline, I think, and really mm-hmm. trying to do that character justice.
Yeah.
There's a lot of freedom with Lucy Hay as well for the actor, I feel like, because there's not as much information about her motivations and what she was thinking and what she wanted. The actor can decide for themselves and play and put their own stamp on it. We did actually have someone who was cast as Lucy Hay in it, but it might not have been completely obvious. Rob, when he was in the red wig.
Oh, yes.
Lucy Hay. We kind of like the idea of someone dragging up to play Lucy Hay and
I think we wanted to play around a bit with gender and things like that too, didn't we? And Aminita playing obviously Digby and the Prince of Wales. So yeah, I think what they did brilliantly is that when watching that, that wasn't the first thing that came to mind.
It was,
you know, they were that good at those roles that really wasn't at the forefront of what you were thinking. And I think that's really important to remember that, you know, providing you're doing that character justice, it doesn't matter who's playing them.
Yeah,
fantastic.
And it reminds us as well, sorry to interrupt you, it reminds us also that they're still those kids in the classroom, so that as if they've got like a dress up box and they're kind of playing out the characters and things. So it has that kind of that Brechtian thing that keeps the audience slightly outside of it, so they go, okay, what do I actually think about this, and not necessarily getting really emotionally sucked in, and they can still be objective about the whole situation.
God, that is so, it's so exciting. Really is exciting to watch it. Now, what I would like to ask you both on behalf of all of our listeners here is, how can our listeners support the production? What can we do to help?
We're working really hard at the moment to try and make the production and everything around it more accessible. So we're hoping to have a kind of a development announcement at some point in the near future. In the meantime, you can be up to date with all the news for 50 Days, following us on Twitter, Instagram, 50Days_musical, all lowercase. Just make sure you're tuning in for any announcements that we're going to have shortly. And hopefully we'll be able to share more of the showcase that we did, our future developments with the wider world, fairly shortly. So make sure you're tuned.
Yeah, agreed. I feel like, shouting about us on social media, but also if any of the audience are theatre producers, work in theatre, think they know anyone that would be interested in funding, you know, getting us a kind of space to work with the show, that would be great. And yeah, get in touch with us.
Yeah, I think, you know, theatre's taken a massive hit, and at the moment it's very hard to get new writing out there, because the priorities are a bit different at the moment. But you know, we're still here. We're taking the idea forwards, and anyone who's able to support in any way, please get in touch, and we'd love to talk further.
Sounds good. I guess as we draw to an unfortunate close, there's a whole load of stuff I'd like to ask you about the character development in particular, as well as the development of the music and how you work through each piece. And I don't want to call it a tune, it's a piece of music. I guess the real question for listeners is, which side do you think you would have fallen on in 1642? Would you have stuck with the king? Or would you have fought to reign in his rule? Tabo?
I always give quite a kind of diplomatic answer. I wouldn't have chosen any side, because I think actually when you're given ultimatums, that can be really dangerous. And I think, you know, I'm sure we can all agree that the contemporary ultimatums that we're given never end well. But I think, you know, with my background, my grandma on my mum's side grew up in Germany. She wound up in Hoheneck prison for a number of years after World War II for anti-Soviet information pamphleting. South African family, black South African, you know, growing up, you know, kind of having to contend with apartheid. I think it's clearly in my nature to fight for what's right. So I think With a gun to my head, I would probably, I would have been on the side of change if people felt that change was needed. But, you know, the royalist clothing, I think, would probably suit me a bit better. I think to do justice to my family, I'd be fighting for good change, I would hope. But I think that question is really difficult, and you need to consider people's region, you know, where in the country they're located, mm-hmm. just their upbringing, you know, age, gender, economic circumstances. I think it's a very complicated question. And that's not my history teacher answer right there.
Cool. So I feel like if I was in the time and I had no knowledge as to what's coming afterwards, I would have been on the side of the round heads, and I would have been like, yeah, revolution, yeah. But as someone who's living now, if I was then transported back into 1642, I think I would definitely be a royalist, because the Puritan era was just, it just seemed like hell. I think I'd rather have a king and have Christmas than have no dancing, no music for like ages. So yeah, hindsight me, royalist.
Yeah, I think those, and you know, I think equally, we know the outcome of the period, and we know that actually the revolution by 1947, it's already taking a bit of a different direction. It's not necessarily going the way that certainly I think the more radical thinkers thought it would go. You know, we do toy with the democracy for a 10-year period, but we wind up with a tyrant, and you know, it kind of dies a very short and sharp death. But I would agree with the jazz. I think you know, for clearly we're theatre lovers, so you know we count, right?
That's an excellent answer. And hey, look, Tabo, I mean, John Dryden did some of his best work while the theatres were shut during the plague, so you know, you're channeling that, being a playwright at home with no theatres open.
Yeah, no, I've got a shout out to my little boy, to Roman Lucas Stuck, being a good boy on the train and letting Daddy write, and you know, and just being a big fan too of the project. Yeah, he's been great.
That's fantastic. Listen, thank you so much to you both, Tabo Stuck and Ayaz Awad, for coming in and just talking to us about this fantastic production. We cannot wait to see what happens next.
Thanks, guys. Thank you for having us.
Thank you so much. Yeah, and yeah, thank you for anyone who's engaged with us on social media, anyone who came, bought a ticket online, in person. It's been a phenomenal start to the journey, and we hope that you'll all come with us on the next step of it now.
Definitely.
When our guests join us to talk about their work and their new book, the 45 minutes or so they spend with us is just a taster of all their efforts. So to this end, we have launched our very own bookshop on bookshop.org, where you can find our guests' latest and greatest books. You can support them, and you can support History Hack too. 10% of every sale via our bookshop supports the podcast and allows us to keep at it and bring you more amazing guests. You can find our bookshop at bookshop.org/shop/History Hack, or just search on bookshop.org for us under the shops bit. Thank you for your continued support, and here's to your next great book.